Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I am Jim Behnke, and this is the July 10th, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, this promises to be a very interesting show today, as we are standing by to have none other than Apollo 11 moonwalker Buzz Aldrin join us by phone today from Washington, D.C., where he is right now spending the last few moments doing a book signing at the National Air and Space Museum. I talked to him just a couple of minutes ago, and he's got quite a long line. We've compromised, and he's going to join us starting in the second segment of the show at about 2:19 today. So we're going to update you on some other things during our first segment here and then get to Buzz for the rest of the program. Of course, you are invited to be a part of this program today, a very special edition, by giving us a call at 321-768-1240 from anywhere that you are. A great chance to talk to Buzz today. Local AT&T wireless customers here on the Space Coast can dial *1240, and that'll give you a free phone call right here to the studio. And if you happen to be listening online at WMMBAM.com, or maybe you're just shy and would prefer to send us some email, the address is spacetalking@AOL.com. And we've already got a couple of emails in the queue here, even as the program starts. So that's the plan for today. Let me give you an update here on what's going on. And there's a couple of neat things that happened this past week in space that I was going to ask Buzz about. Maybe we'll get to it again later. But the first thing is that an incredible piece of space technology was I don't know if it was proven so much as it was certainly demonstrated that it would work, and that is the idea of a solar sail. You know, here on the Space Coast with all our water and the intercoastal waterway and out in the ocean, you see these grand sailing ships with their sails unfurled and being pushed along by the wind. And it turns out that you can do the same thing in space. Of course, there's no wind in space, not any blowing air anyway, but there are blowing photons coming from the sun that are blowing in the vacuum of space. A photon being a measurement of light, a unit of light, a particle. The grand old debate about particles and waves. It's an actual little kind of thing that's out there blowing away. And the notion for many years has been that you could actually take a very lightweight material, and if it was big enough, it could capture enough of these photons or at least be deflected by enough of these photons that you could actually get a movement, acceleration, that you could get propulsion without using any chemical rocket engines whatsoever. And this notion has been thought of and tested and theorized and launches attempted to get into orbit by various organizations through the years. I can remember a couple of submarine launches from Russia wanting to test this concept with some universities. And the best of my knowledge, none of them ever really did make it to orbit or deploy successfully. But yet now Japan recently launched a rocket into space to deploy a satellite. And this smaller spacecraft was ejected as sort of a secondary hitchhiker payload, and it unfurled this solar sail, a sail that stretched about 46 feet. It's kind of a square, weird kind of square-shaped thing. Basically, if you picture a square 46 feet wide, about 66 feet in diameter, and kind of gold on one side, silver on another to better reflect the sunlight, and these photons hitting this thing, and they actually now announced yesterday, Japan did, that this thing did accelerate. It did pick up speed once the solar sail was unfurled. And so for the first time now in space history, we've demonstrated this technology that that you could use a sail to move in space without needing a chemical or any other kind of a rocket engine. It's very small scale. In fact, the measurement of the acceleration was, let's see if I got this right, 1/4,000th of a single pound of thrust. Now consider, you know, shuttles basically 7 million pounds of thrust when it lifts off. You know, you're a million plus on just about any rocket lifting off from the Cape. Shuttle maneuver engineering, the orbital maneuvering system engines that break the shuttle to come back to Earth. There's two of them, and they each have 6,000 pounds of thrust. In fact, I think even in one of our model rocket friends would have to send me a quick note to confirm this. But I think even a engine model rocket probably has more newtons of thrust than this thing demonstrated. But nevertheless, it worked. And the idea, of course, in space is that you can have constant acceleration. So as this thing was unfurled and exposed to sunlight, if you were in a spaceship, it would start accelerating and it would constantly accelerate. It would constantly accelerate. And these photons move pretty quick, obviously. And so not necessarily that you could ever get to the speed of light or anything, but, you know, theoretically you could get going pretty good. And again, sail, using sail like you would any other boat to maneuver and steer. And that's the next step now for these Japanese scientists, is to take the solar sail and twist it, if you will, bend it, move it, change its orientation to see whether or not you could affect changes in your course and speed. And so, really, really neat stuff from Japan. And the kind of technology, frankly, that I think we need to be working on in our nation, and the kind of thing we need to concentrate on as we look to the future of our space program and what we're doing, this idea of a destination and going to a specific place as the goal is certainly out there and visionary. But along the way, I think we need to be spending more time on this. And that's something that we'll talk about with Buzz here in just a little bit. Another thing that happened this week that directly affects us here at the Space Coast and the Space Shuttle program is that the final external tank was rolled out from the Michoud assembly facility over there by in New Orleans, and it will soon be on its way by barge here to the Kennedy Space Center. This tank is the one destined for Endeavour to launch on, use next February, which as of this moment still remains the final space shuttle launch planned by NASA. There continues to be movement and action on the idea of flying Space Shuttle Atlantis one more time after the Endeavour flight, and there is an external tank for that flight. It is still in New Orleans at the Michoud facility. It was a tank that was fully assembled and then was damaged when Hurricane Katrina blew through there, and they are now repairing that tank. It's in final assembly, and the word is that that will be shipped to Kennedy in September. Right now, that's the launch on need mission. That's the emergency rescue mission that Atlantis will be standing by to fly if needed. And if that mission is not needed, then of course there's still the talk about Atlantis flying one more time. Senator Nelson this week did talk about a compromise in the authorization bill, and I don't want to give away all the details of that because, again, that's one of the key things we're going to talk about with Buzz. But the idea of flying at least one more shuttle mission and using that external tank is certainly right up there as a possibility. A couple other quick things that I just want to call your attention to. The FAA did approve Space Launch Complex 46 this week, gave Space Florida its launch site operator's license for that. That's another big movement here in terms of getting more launches from the Cape, more commercial activity here at Cape Canaveral. It's one of those bureaucratic paperwork things that isn't really a big headline, but was an absolutely necessary step toward Space Florida being able to attract more launches here to the Cape. Space Launch Complex 46 is the dual-use pad that the Trident used to test off of and the Lockheed Martin Athena launches from. Well, look, we're going to take a quick break here and return, and we'll have Buzz Aldrin with us as Space Talk continues, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Benke, and you're listening to WMMB.
now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And greetings once again from Florida Space Coast and the home of the Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. Well, this coming Friday marks the 41st anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch, the first lunar landing mission. Neil Armstrong, of course, was the commander. Mike Collins was the command module pilot. And Buzz Aldrin was the lunar module pilot. And as you all well know, on July 20th, 1969, Neil and Buzz became the first men to land and walk on the moon. And because of that feat four decades ago, I really don't need to say anything else, I don't think, by way of introduction, except to say, of course, I'm honored to welcome to the program today none other than the legendary Buzz Aldrin. Buzz, welcome to Space Talk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Jim. I'm very happy to be talking to you from the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, very cool. Now, you spent the last couple hours doing a book signing, and you had a lot of interest there. You see that interest, don't you? There's, the general public still cares about this program.
Well, I sure do. There were just all sorts of different people from different nations, young people that just were wide-eyed as could be, and very happy tourists coming by, and I just was really thrilled to see their appreciation and memory of the things that this country did 40 years ago.
Well, let's ask you a couple of the obligatory anniversary type questions. I know that the 41st anniversary is not exactly a big celebrated milestone like the fives are and all that, but in any case, after all this time, Buzz, you know, when you think back to those times, really even starting when you were selected and all through Gemini and Apollo, you know, what's the most vivid memory for you? I would assume those memories are still vivid. You know, what do you think about as a highlight? What really resonates with you after all these years?
Well, there were so many events during that mission itself, and it took 8 days total, 3.5 days to get to the moon, about 1 day there, actually 20 hours plus a little bit on the surface of the moon, and about 2.5 hours for Neil outside, about a little over 2 hours for me to be outside on the lunar surface. But I think the most significant recollection and event really consisted of the first landing on another object by a machine created by human beings and operated and landed by human beings so that then they could explore the landing itself. And, of course, the 11 minutes or so of power descent where we slowed down from orbital speed. And at that time, if the engine quit, we were going to crash. And at any time during that 11 minutes, if something happened, we were not on a survivable trajectory unless we did very critical things like jettisoning the descent stage, lighting up the ascent stage, and then getting back into a proper orbit. So really, landing on another object was the culmination of the commitment to go to the moon. Once you land, you can land a second time, a third time, a sixth, seventh, and eighth, and then you can land on another object like an asteroid, or you can land on Mars. And once you know how to land, then you can send people outside and they can do whatever you want to do as many days as you are able to do it.
Right.
So the actual touchdown instant that was successful, I think, is the most significant in my mind. And it was preceded, of course, by a light coming on in the cockpit that indicated that a probe from the landing gear had just touched the lunar surface, and it caused that light to be turned on. And as I saw that, I told Neil, engine stop, and a few other things, and that's what happened in those fractions of a second as we touched down on the lunar surface, when it became okay to say a few words back to Earth, back to Houston, instead of talking to each other, why Neil Armstrong gave those prophetic words, Houston, Tranquility Base, the Eagle has landed.
Yeah, isn't that great? And when you know, there was definitely emotion in Mission Control as they all let out their whoops and stuff. Of course, you guys being the professional engineers, astronauts, pilots, with all those switches to throw and checklists to go through, I imagine there wasn't a single emotion in your body when you finally realized you landed, right?
Well, of course, being the rendezvous expert, where I had studied rendezvous while at MIT, and of course that was my entree ticket into the astronaut business,
right?
Because I hadn't been, I hadn't personally selected the option of becoming trained as a test pilot in my Air Force career. So really, it was my work at MIT on rendezvous that made the big difference. After touchdown, I was quite aware that we had several opportunities, T1, T2, T3, mm-hmm. that it would be appropriate to lift off at that time if anything was leaking, if anything was wrong with the spacecraft after we touched down. So I was quite conscious of the countdown to those times. And the reason that those times occur a minute and something after touchdown is so that if we lifted off, Mike Collins and Columbia would be in a favorable position to catch up with him and to complete the rendezvous. But once T3 had passed, then we were stuck on the surface for 2 hours until he came over again.
Wow! Wow! And that and of course Mike was very anxious to stay on top of that and worried a lot about that. Very well articulated in his book, Carrying the Fire. Buzz, the questions are lining up here, and we're gonna take a few as best we can and stick to the topic. Jim,
sure.
Jim from West Melbourne, he says he was 13 in 1969. I think he has a question that's going to allow you to say something nice about the local folks. Jim, what's your question?
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Aldrin, and congratulations 40 years later. I was 13. My father was one of the support people out there. So many of them, there's no way for you to know, but if I could just tell you very quickly, he was a guy who had to quit school in the eighth grade because his father was so ill, working a farm up in North Dakota, and he ended up down here in the 50s and working at the Space Center, and he handled the liquid oxygen and liquid nitrogen, high-pressure gas, and actually got awards from NASA for his procedures that he wrote. And I thought maybe you'd like to comment on some of those thousands of support people who helped you to get to the moon.
Jim, that's a great comment and great question. Thanks for calling. And yeah, Buzz, you guys were the top of the pyramid on top of that Saturn V, but you know who supported you.
Well, there's no doubt that we became aware of that from the moment that we were selected as astronauts. In my case, back in October of 1963, I had applied for the astronaut program in 1962, along with my good friend from West Point, Ed White,
right,
who was later killed in the Apollo fire. But he was qualified, and I wasn't because I didn't have the test pilot qualifications. But the next year, they modified those so that that was not a requirement, put more emphasis on education, so I was selected. So from that point on, we had a suspicion that we just might be a part of a great national commitment and effort to land some of us on the moon before the end of the 1960s, before January 1st, 1970. And as the team began to form around this epic mission and define exactly how we were going to carry this out, more and more people from industry, different companies, different agencies of the U.S. government, the State Department, the Commerce Department, of course, NASA, and many other agencies began to really concentrate and assemble the people, call on the universities, and of course the political people in Congress, and the White House, of course, had to continue their support. So there was upwards of 400,000 people, but a whole nation really began to solidify behind this effort as the time became closer and closer. And yes, the crew was very aware of the potential success of carrying out. But we were focused on doing the very best job that we possibly could, everyone on that major team. And I think the pride swelled as it got closer and closer. And then as the mission was launched, and then as we made our orbit changes that resulted in the final descent, I think millions and millions of people around the world were focused with great pride and appreciation for what America was about to do.
Buzz, we need to pause right there. I'm sorry, we need to pause right there. We're going to take a five-minute break, come back with more from Buzz, and talk about the future of the space program and his thoughts on that. This is Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Be here for the heroes in orange jumpsuits.
Be here to feed your curiosity.
Be here for the goosebumps.
Major goosebumps.
Be here for the eye-opening.
Jaw-dropping.
Excitement.
Of exploring space.
Be here for a day of fun.
And a lifetime of inspiration.
Be here at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. From now until July 11th, stop by participating McDonald's restaurants for a coupon worth $5 off your admission to Kennedy Space Center.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to the second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Of course, we're talking today to none other than Buzz Aldrin. You can join us with a question or a brief comment by dialing 321-768-1240, *1240 for the local AT&T wireless customers. And our email address, if you're listening online or just prefer it that way, is spacetalking@aol.com. Well, of course, Buzz Aldrin, the famous moonwalker, but also recently famous for his stint on Dancing with the Stars. Buzz has trained his namesake Buzz Lightyear for astronaut duty, among other things. I even caught Buzz once not too long ago presenting a showcase on The Price is Right, which I thought was fabulous, and he did a great job. And Buzz, you know, you do those kind of things, and you're really putting yourself out there in a way that so few other of your colleagues do. Talk about why that's important to you to do, and what do you learn from doing those things?
Well, what really prompted this was a desire for a little more publicity on the paperback issue of my latest autobiography, Magnificent Desolation.
Right.
The paperback issue came out on the 1st of June. The hardcover was about a year earlier, and I just got through signing about 700 books here at the Air and Space Museum. So the hardcover and children's books are still very popular. But in additional publicity, a publicist that we've known for quite some while had contacts with different high-visibility TV shows, and it resulted in a query to them and from them, would I be interested in appearing as a contestant on Dancing with the Stars?
Yeah.
And I remember getting a phone call. I was in the offices of the science advisor to the president when that phone call came in to me. And I picked up my cell phone, and after hesitating a moment or two, I said, yeah, I think I would like to do that. So that was the beginning of getting ready and training very intensely for a wonderful challenge Now, in retrospect, the really real reason that I wanted to do that was so that Buzz Aldrin and his image, his past of having landed on the moon as part of the Apollo program in 1969 would clearly be on people's minds when they see that that contest show, very popular, of Dancing with the Stars. And when they see my name mentioned, they will somewhat think back of the great successes we had in the 60s and 70s in our space program. And also, they will probably think about the space program today. I wonder which way it's going. And I wonder whether Buzz Aldrin really has some good ideas about the direction that the space program would have. And I think that the appearance on that show succeeded magnificently in bringing those subjects in front of the American people. And now, as the time moves on and we come closer to deciding just exactly what we as a nation will take on as some kind of a long-range program for our future, just what will that be like? And, of course, I'm ready and willing to begin to talk about what I think we should be doing.
Well, and to move on to that topic, Buzz, we have an email question from Dennis in Vieira, Florida here. And let me just ask it the way he poses it, because I think it'll help us get into this topic. He says, or he asks, is it true that Buzz Aldrin does not support going back to the moon? If not, why?
Buzz Aldrin is aware of the events that brought into motion the program that ended up being called Constellation. And actually, in 2002, a number of NASA people felt that we would continue to fly the space shuttle until 2020 or 2025. But that came to an end on February 1st of 2003 with the loss of the Columbia space shuttle on reentry and the loss of seven members in its crew. Mm-hmm. So during the next summer, the accident board was meeting, and NASA exploration people were convened and looking at what should be the steps that might be taken now that we only have three orbiters left. Now, the accident board came up with its recommendations, and some of those really led to retiring the orbiter in 2010, and it said that we should separate crew and cargo. That got interpreted as having a separate rocket for the crew and another one for the lander and everything else. And I believe the combination of setting the deadline of 2020 required that under those circumstances, we began to develop two rocket systems, a spacecraft that was decided to be similar to Apollo. And as that progressed, we began to see that we just were not succeeding according to the budget and the schedule, and the funding for that was not what was needed as we began to learn how to do going back to the moon with those circumstances. And as a result, we began to get further and further behind and more costly to complete and to catch up. With a potential landing back on the moon, not by 2020, but perhaps by 2030, which would have been 60 years after having landed on the moon just before 1970. So it just didn't seem to me that that was the way we ought to be going with a new administration that had campaigned on change and international cooperation, improvement, expansion. I began to see that, yes, indeed, it was time to begin to modify what we had set in motion and to come up with revisions to that constellation program with Ares 1, Ares 5, and a spacecraft that was going to be rather expensive if its destination was only to take people to the space station and back initially, and then to land in the ocean. That didn't impress me hardly at all, and it doesn't. So I believe that the changes that have been put in place lay the groundwork with technology advancements and further being specific about exactly what it is we intend to do in the next 10, 20, 30 years of our space program. So I'm on the side of saying, yes, we need to be more specific, but we have cleared the way from a very expensive, unsustainable program that if it was carried out, was going to be much slower, and much more costly. So that doesn't mean we're abandoning the moon in any way. I'm part of a paper being planned right now for the International Lunar Infrastructure Development Corporation. That's an international corporation that the United States clearly has the background and experience to be a leader in that corporation to develop the moon, not to explore it again. We have done that. We can continue to explore and develop with robots with the time delay as short as it is between Earth and the moon. We can help other nations in their efforts to show their people the progress that they've made to inspire the people of China, India, Europe, Japan, Brazil, South Korea, as Apollo inspired our people. And while we conserve our resources and direct our resources outward in a gradual, very determined, I think, two-phase program that says that we should not just go to Mars with humans, but permanently settle on Mars. And I think the time period is within the decade of the 2030s, between 2030 and 2040. But I think we need to reaffirm that pathway around 2020, and a convenient time is 6 months before that, on July 20th, 2019.
Right.
That's the 50th anniversary of landing on the moon. So that's the plan that I think we should embark on.
Well, Buzz, we're gonna do one more 2-minute break here. When we come back, I'm going to ask you about Senator Nelson's proposals in his authorization committee this week as a compromise. But in the meantime, I do want to remind everyone that Buzz's book, Magnificent Desolation, as he just said, is out in paperback, has been updated since the hardcover came out. And you can find links to that book as well as two of his kids' books, which are very popular, through Amazon at the Space Talk website, WMMB.com. Just enter the keywords Space Talk, and you'll find links to those publications that you can buy through Amazon and support Space Talk at the same time. So again, when we come back from this 2-minute break, we're going to talk more with Buzz Aldrin, get his views on some of the compromises that are out there, one or two last questions as well. Space Talk is brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Behnke, and you're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. Buzz, this past week, Senator Nelson spoke about a compromise, if you will, in his authorization bill that he thinks he can get passed sometime this week. And, of course, it'll have many hurdles to follow after that. But the highlights to me were talking about at least, in quotes, one additional shuttle launch, probably the Atlantis supply flight, accelerate a shuttle-derived heavy lift vehicle, go back to developing a full Orion capsule, not just the scaled-back version that the president proposed in April, extend the life of the space station in full support to 2020, And again, hoping to pass that as early as this week. Does that at all make sense to you in what you've just been talking about and getting something that we can all agree on to move forward with?
Well, Jim, I hope I can quickly review where I stand on something like that and give you some thoughts about it. A year and a half ago, leading up to the time when I presented my plan for the future to the Augustine Commission, which had 90 days to evaluate different options and then to submit them to the White House last summer, a little less than a year ago, it submitted those plans. I felt that what we could do was to take the last five or six or so shuttle missions and stretch them out to one-year centers, and that would take it on through 2015, perhaps. And by that time, we certainly ought to be able to develop a follow-on to the shuttle somehow and the launch system that could do that. Now, when I look at 30 years plus of landing on a runway and what has been studied in the past by NASA, 8 years and $800 million on a design that most people think is very, very good and advanced. It lands on a runway. It can carry eight people up and down to the space station, and it has had considerable wind tunnel tests. I felt that is what should be the follow-on spacecraft to the space shuttle. And we could perhaps launch that on rockets derived from the space shuttle. And therefore, I began to support that spacecraft, and it selected the Atlas V as the rocket to be man-rated to put that spacecraft up, but then to make use of the shuttle rocket systems that put the shuttle up, and to have either a direct shuttle system with engines on the bottom of the tank or a side mount cargo compartment with the engines on the side. And that's what I believe we should do. And then we should embark immediately on a long duration life support system. And with that and modifications to Orion, we could carry out progressive long-duration space flights. Since that time, I began to re-examine the specialized spacecraft of the command module and the lunar lander that made Apollo a success, and to apply that thinking to returning from Mars or going to and returning and having specialized redundant spacecraft come back from Mars and not make the landing into the ocean, but make aero capture and then have the crew rendezvous and join up with the runway lander that I just got through describing.
Right, right.
And that was a variation. And then when the president's budget came out and it appeared as though the selection of a flexible path plus some redetermination and perhaps a cancellation of parts of the Constellation program, I began to support that, but still with a shuttle derived. Now, as soon as the president said a new rocket system with liquid rockets as boosters and as core stage, I shifted that support away from continuing to have solid rockets a part of the launch system. For 20 years, my engineers and I have not felt that the shuttle system with solid rockets was the safety we needed for the future. And I was against things that would prolong the use of solid rockets. And when the president said that we were going to move in that direction, terminate the shuttle program, start on a new rocket system, then it became a contentious issue as to whether the workforce that would be dislocated primarily in Houston, Texas, in Texas and in Alabama and in Florida were going to be impacted by that. And I felt that perhaps the political steps taken to perhaps assure that that was not too distasteful, especially in the politically necessary state of Florida.
Right.
Now, if it's not my fault if that decision is made. However, if that decision is made, I will stand behind it because I believe the president and the direction will weather that that dislocation and that series of layoffs during this period when many, many people are without jobs. Right. The ones that are talented in space and science and technology should have a better chance of getting another job in a new expanding program than the many other small business people who have been dislocated.
Hey Buzz, we need to let me cut you off there because we're running out of time. Can you give me about a 15-second elevator speech and real quick on your Share Space Foundation? We just got about 20 seconds.
Okay, my nonprofit efforts really are two right now. Star Buzz Education Ambassadors who work with parents. These are retired science teachers. They work with parents throughout the nation to embark on extracurricular school programs.
Right.
Star Buzz Space Prizes is a lottery-like availability of experiences, not items. You win it or you use it or lose it, and it's a lottery-type selection.
And the website for you to get to all that?
Well, it's evolving right now.
Okay.
I have an iPhone. I have an iPhone application and an iPad,
and the iPad
application,
brand new.
And BuzzAldrin.com, where you can see information on this, and you can also see my unified space vision.
Buzz,
into the 2030s.
We got to cut you off there. Thanks for being on the show today. Thanks to everyone again for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Space Talk. We'll talk to you again real soon. By the way, don't miss what's coming up next. The Home Mortgage Law Show is next, followed by Dan Connery live and local at 4 p.m.